Recording. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Oh, your little faces light up when you talk.
They're so happy.
That's what's killing the bandwidth on Skype and ruining the call.
The glowing faces?
Yeah.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
So I'm recording. Just using a call recorder as we did last time, which seems to be of tolerable quality. And we all have the list of topics.
Yes.
Sure.
I'll paste the link here. Oh. I think, Stephen, you mentioned that you wanted to have like introductions. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
So why don't you start?
Okay, I'm Stephen. I am from Cookeville, living in Atlanta, working mostly on the front end. And Trey is my neighbor from childhood.
This is true. Everybody on the podcast, except for Kale, has lived in Cookeville.
Oh.
Pork. Wow. So I, like, hang up, or...?
Well, Kale has visited Cookeville for up to 3 hours at a time.
Yes.
That's all you need.
So that counts. Okay. That counts.
Pretty much seen everything.
Yeah. I'm Trey. And I grew up next door to Steven in Cookeville. And I also work mostly on front-end web development. Next. Kale.
All right. I'm Kale. So probably take the whole podcast, but born in Chattanooga, lived in Nashville, lived in South Florida, lived in Nashville again. And currently do a lot of front-end web development as well.
I lived in Chattanooga.
All right. I lived there for 2 months when I was, like, 2 months old.
So.
Oh, right on.
No, I currently live in Nashville, so if I didn't say that. Jason?
Which Jason?
You're the only Jason here.
Oh, Jason Johnson hasn't joined us. So.
Right. I don't think he's going to join us tonight.
Loser.
I know.
Well, I'm Jason. I'll just go by Jason then. And I'm a content developer, which is a fancy word for technical writer for a big software and firm, and who does engineering software. And I currently live just outside of Nashville in Franklin. But I also lived in Cookeville for a long time when I was in college.
So that Franklin, do Franklinites say they live in Nashville?
When you get far enough away from Nashville, yeah, you kind of have to.
Yeah.
I met a lot of Franklinites in college, and they were very specific that they were from Franklin.
But Brentwood seems to think it's Nashville, though, right?
It's better than Nashville.
It's debatable.
Well, in their opinion.
Stephen, I think you're absolutely right, especially whenever people are talking to people from Nashville or anywhere in Tennessee. They are very adamant that people from Franklin are not Nashville. But I work with enough people from elsewhere that I can't really say I'm from Franklin, Tennessee, and have the slightest clue where I'm from.
Right.
It's easier to say Nashville than Cookeville, also.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I live in Laverne, but for all intents and purposes, let's say Nashville.
What did you say? Yeah, it was like a mile and a half from Davidson County or something like that? Or
if that, maybe a quarter mile.
Oh, cool. Well, the topics have follow-up things, but I don't know. It's been a month, I guess, since the last time we recorded, so I don't know if...
What? Has it been that long?
It's been maybe... It's been 2 or 3 weeks. It's been... Right? Somebody back me up here.
Two weeks, I think.
2 weeks. Is that it? Oh. It's been so long, it feels like forever. Okay. So, do we want to cover? So it was September 8th was the last episode. Recorded September 7th.
That's three.
Wow. And today is the 27th.
Insanity.
Crazy. So we'll try to keep this up more often than that. Well, the follow-up topics were, we were talking about, like, tutorials on learning programming so that had been brought up, maybe in terms of functional programming or something. But I forgot that Stephen Frank of Panic Software did a ebook on learning programming called How to Count. And I thought that was worth mentioning. He's a pretty good writer and obviously talented software developer, if the quality of Panic Software is any indication. And I guess, Stephen, did you add this note for what is functional programming? And then there's some...
I had thought about removing it. We had talked about it, and we hadn't come entirely clear. And let's see. Go back one version. There it is. Functional programming, kind of the textbook definition. And I actually got the chance to go to a conference last weekend, 2 weekends ago, that talked a lot about functional programming, why it's important. And as computing grows to where you're working across multiple computers, say you can't rely on state being maintained between all the systems, that's where functional programming becomes really valuable, in that one of the goals of functional programming is to minimize state and side effects of functions. So every function is like an equation in math. It's each side is true. It's equal. They're equal to each other. And you'll always get the same answer whenever you call any function with the same inputs, because there is no state outside of them. So... That was a big thing. There were some big deal guys there. It was called Strange Loop. It was in St. Louis. The first guy who spoke was named Eric Meyer, and he is not the Eric Meyer that we all know from CSS.
I'm confused.
Yeah.
There is another Eric Meyer, spelled different.
Of course.
Differently. He talked about category theory, monads, and duality in big data.
You say monads?
Monads.
Okay.
Wait, what?
What's that noise?
Yeah, there's something crazy going on.
Oh, what are you hearing?
Air conditioner? Washer, I think.
Steven's getting quieter and quieter.
Is someone in a moving vehicle?
I'm not hearing anything weird. Hello?
Well, since you're recording, it should be okay.
Who's hearing weird things?
I am.
Jason is.
Oh. Kale is. And I don't hear Steven at all anymore.
I'll be right back.
Could you hear that?
Yeah.
When Steven said, I'll be right back? Anybody? Uh-oh.
Oh, not any better. But I'm back.
I think there was a connectivity issue here.
Okay.
I think the call dropped for a second.
Oh, is it just you and me?
It's just you and me for now, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so it was a really interesting conference. I'll wait for them to get back and really get into it.
Well, you can get into it, and they can listen to the podcast later, because we're still...
Yeah, so a lot of it didn't even deal with the front end. Which is cool, because that's just really interesting. The first talk really got into NoSQL, which he has deemed co-SQL instead of NoSQL, because he doesn't like the negative connotation that gives, and he thinks that there's a duality, like a yin and a yang, between SQL and co-SQL.
Uh-huh.
You know, they have inverse relationships in all ways. For example, in SQL... your children point to the parent. You get the children of a parent by querying whatever table the children are in and looking for that parent's ID, right? But in a co-SQL, the parents just point directly to the children. And he goes down this list of 8 or 10 things, and each thing is reversed.
crazy.
There was a good one about functional thinking. This guy took a bunch of Java code, very object-oriented Java code, and transformed it into a more functional approach, and he showed us why that was good. Kind of got us thinking in a different paradigms, like map, reduce, fold. Introduced us to Groovy. I had never seen Groovy before. It's pretty interesting. It's a dynamic language on the JVM. Let's see.
Groovy.
A lot of talk about lambda calculus at this conference, which, I mean, they talked about some serious stuff. Kind of made me interested. And then there was one talk that was very front-end oriented, and it was mind-blowing Canvas demos. Dude is writing a book right now. It's a really good book based on everything that he showed us from it. I'll definitely recommend it, and we'll be buying it. He basically is going to show you all sorts of amazing things you can do on the canvas. He has a background in other, you know, rendering engines were a lot like Canvas. And he will take you through the whole thing. He builds like a paint clone. The first thing he did was he wrote a clock. Ticks around, shows you the time. Goes over all sorts of things you can do with Canvas. It's called Core HTML5 and Core Canvas. That is his book, Core Canvas. We'll put a link in the show notes. He even gets into doing some pretty fantastic things like taking a video, have a hidden video element, and draw the image from the video onto the canvas at a really rapid rate. You know, like 16 frames a second is what he tended to go through, and he could then change the coloring, flip the image over, do all these fancy things in real time with multiple videos running because it's that fast.
That's it.
Ooh, yes, one of my favorite talk. It was by a guy from Heroku about Heroku called Running Heroku on Heroku. They actually have reached the point where they run their application on their own platform.
Is that like writing the code for a text editor in that text editor?
Yes, or it's like CoffeeScript can now compile CoffeeScript.
That's nonsense.
You know, GCC can compile GCC, right? That's a bootstrapped language is a language that can compile itself. And he kind of opened up his presentation talking about a bootstrapped language and how amazing that is, how that's the goal of any language author. And then he kind of paralleled that to kind of bootstrapping Heroku, and that they dog food on their own product now.
Fancy.
It's pretty amazing how the whole thing works. That is one of the most impressive apps out there. That and GitHub. GitHub's probably the best executed app on the internet.
Better than Google?
Yes.
Better than
in terms of just
all
how,
of Google?
Well,
all of Google? Better than Gmail?
That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Alright, I like GitHub. I can go for that.
It's valid.
We had a GitHub drink up in Atlanta last night.
I saw your Instagram or whatever.
Yeah. One of the guys, they hired him a couple months ago. He's an Atlanta native. He was coming home to visit. And so they always take opportunities like that to buy everybody lots of drinks. So
nice.
We met up at a microbrewery, which is directly across the street from my apartment, and drank a lot.
Convenient.
Yeah.
Ooh-hoo.
Cool.
So yeah, that about wraps up the conference.
I would like to meet some GitHub people in person. That would be cool.
Yeah, nice guy.
Who was it?
His name was Matt Todd.
Matt Todd. What does he do at GitHub?
He really didn't talk about code a lot for the whole night. at all.
He has two first names.
He does.
He is not a New Zealand rugby union football player.
Okay.
He is M. Todd on GitHub.
M. Todd.
Matt Todd, GitHub. He is an acclaimed Rubyist and prolific open source developer. He's helping them with their GitHub Fi product.
Oh.
It's a GitHub firewall.
Yes.
Drop it in your own place.
Interesting. Cool. Okay. So.
And there is one more takeaway from this conference. It's the most important one, I think. Basically, they stressed a lot how JavaScript is going to be the ubiquitous language of the next era of computing. JavaScript will be the language to know or target for everything.
I believe it.
Yeah.
The way this conversation was about post-PC era, what a stupid name that is. People are saying we're entering the post-PC era, so that's like calling the PC era the post-mainframe era. Well, what's that mean? It doesn't mean anything. That would be like we're entering the post-post-mainframe era. Offered what he considers to be a better title, which is the ambient computing era. So the browser won't go away. Or the browser will go away, he's saying. The browser is transitory. It's moving us toward a new era where web technologies will become the dominant everything around us. It will surround us, and we won't even notice it. But we won't know what to do without it.
You know, in a way, the cloud is the mainframe, though. It's a little cyclical, in my opinion. I mean, you're not running applications necessarily, but, well, I guess, even applications through the browser.
And browsers are the terminals.
Yeah.
What about that?
Yeah.
It seems like a lot of people are talking about browsers going away in the future. But the internet will be around in the form of HTTP connecting APIs.
And so everything is just apps running on... devices. I don't know. Browsers are getting like more and more powerful, though.
Yeah,
it's true. I'm rooting for them.
That's what I do. Right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so let's.
TextMate 2.
TextMate 2.
Hmm. Indeed.
Is this for real? This isn't a joke?
It is not a joke.
Because it's not there, April. Close to April right now.
There is an official announcement, which was like a paragraph.
Yeah.
And it was very vague, and it said, before Christmas this year, the most recent episode of Build and Analyze had a 25-minute discussion about this blog post.
Wait a second, Trey. It says there'll be a public alpha.
Alpha, yes.
For Christmas.
Yeah.
Right. It's not out. It's not done by Christmas, but like there'll be some indication that it's not dead. That's it. It's so vague, and it's so like in the software development world. This is what the podcast of Build and Analyze was talking about. It's like in the software development world, saying something is 3 months away is just about a useless thing to say. That's so vague, and you have no. If you're saying something is 3 months away, you really have no idea how much is left to do on it.
Yeah, there's no feature list or anything.
No. Well, so
if they were to go on Kickstarter, I'm sure if they had taken that route instead, I bet it would have.
Well, the funny thing about that is that he even said in 2006, I guess, that this would be a free upgrade. That TextMate 2 would be a free upgrade, and that it would require. Leopard, because Tiger. What was the operator? And you know, just FYI, guys, it's going to require Leopard.
Got it.
And it's going to be a free upgrade. And so, you know, I think that. Somebody eating cereal.
Sorry, that was my chair.
What was I saying? Oh, I think everything will be forgiven if there's any indication that the product is not dead. You know, it's going to be... Because TextMate is still great. If it had a few other little things, it would be great. Of course, this is going to be a total rewrite. But anyway.
Which is always a bad idea.
To rewrite something from scratch? Or to announce something before it's done, or what?
All of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. I question his business logic. I mean, he could literally make bank on this, you know? But like you said, he's talking about releasing it for free.
For people who already... Right, a free upgrade.
Why don't people just use Coda?
Yeah. Listen here, Vim boy. I'm looking forward to it. I am, you know... A few weeks back, I had played around with switching to another editor. I spent some time with BBEdit. I spent some time with Vim. And... I like certain things about both of them. I think if I had a gun to my head and had to not use TextMate, I would probably use Vim. BBEdit is such a huge bloated mess, in my opinion.
Have you tried Sublime?
I don't want to try Sublime. I've seen it. I don't care for it. I don't like how it looks. I don't like how it's some sort of pseudo TextMate thing. People love it, though. There's several people I work with who use it and love it. It just seems like that and things like, what's the chocolate or whatever? Chocolate?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is sort of this TextMate-like thing. And then there's that TextMate, like Vico, I think it's called, where it's very TextMate-like, but it also has Vim key bindings.
Yes.
That's a mess. In my opinion, that's just a mess. Like, I think there are three or four, if you're crazy, choices in text editors. And that's TextMate, Vim, BBEdit, or Emacs. Mm-hmm. Like, those are the same choices. In my opinion.
I can agree with that.
So...
Yeah.
I mean, those are the ones that you know are going to be around. TextMate, the least of those, but... Yeah.
I don't know. I think TextMate rings up there.
Well, it doesn't get maintained like the other ones do. I mean, I can't speak to Emacs at all, but I know some people who use it, and it's been around for decades, so I don't think it's probably going anywhere.
I mean, has Vim had a major release?
That's a good question.
It's still maintained. Recently?
Yeah, it's still maintained.
Yeah.
And TextMate is still maintained. There are still updates. I mean, every once in a while, there's a little update. And it works fine in Lion. It's absolutely fine. It, you know, these days, it kind of needs a few plugins to get it up to snuff visually and functionally. I mean, you've got to use AcMate, and you've got to use the Missing Drawer plugin.
True.
But if you use those things, it's great. And I am almost entirely happy with it. The only things that I'm not happy with are that it's not a real good out-of-the-box experience, and it doesn't feel like it's being maintained. But this announcement makes me hopeful. It's weird. The announcement was weird, but it does make me hopeful. And that's all I got to say about that.
Well, Google, I believe something was leaked about the Dash or Dart programming language. People have been really upset that Google is going to develop something behind the standards committees to potentially replace JavaScript, something that'll run in Chrome. Have you all read about that?
No.
Briefly.
Yeah, I believe the name is now Dart. It was Dash earlier. So sometime soon in October, we're going to hear something about it. I was really excited thinking we're going to see it. Then I realized that actually they're just going to announce it and we probably won't see it for several years.
Oh, wow.
But they do believe that JavaScript is unfortunate and they're trying to bring us a better language to run in browsers, and not only will it run in the browser, but it'll compile down into JavaScript for browsers that don't support the language. Mm-hmm. But the idea is all other browser vendors will see it, think it's awesome, and support it. But
what's Google's motivation to do this?
They want to make the web fast.
In order to serve ads,
yeah,
faster.
Yeah, the more you use the web, the more money Google makes.
This is true.
But the problem with JavaScript on the web is the DOM and inconsistent implementations. So those are two pretty big problems.
Will Dart solve that?
That's what they think. Well, I mean, I think the new ECMA stuff coming out is pretty exciting, too. The Harmony. But that won't run everywhere, either. It's not backwards compatible.
Hmm. It sounds just a tad Silverlight, like, you know?
Yeah. One of their developers, one of the guys who works on Chrome Frame, published a post immediately after this leaked to kind of put out the fires, reassuring us that Google is absolutely dedicated to JavaScript.
They sure make a good browser.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fantastic. Let me see if I can find that. Alex Russell wrote about it. Basically, he didn't tell us anything about Dart at all in the article, but he did let us know that Google is dedicated to JavaScript for in the long haul.
Well, Chrome has some really weird, bizarre handlings for local pages, though. I know it's got some odd security settings that we ship HTML help, and all the files are local on someone's machine. They can't read them if they use Chrome.
Whoa. Oh.
They won't open. So bizarre.
Is there some way around that, or?
There's some hacks, but basically we're just lots of people in the content development and tech writing communities are just pleading with Google to fix that. It makes no sense.
You know, Chrome will also catch XSS and just stop it. If you look in the console, you'll see it. Say you pass a little script tag through an input and it shows up in the markup on the next page, Chrome will suppress that.
Wow.
But that's bad because you don't notice it when you're developing, maybe.
And it's not going to stop it on every browser.
Right.
So, is there, Jason, is there a way to run I don't know. I'm trying to think, like, for developing sites locally, you can use, like, a little Python web server. I guess if it was on a Mac, you could get around it that way.
I don't see why you couldn't do that, to be honest with you. Just basically, but that may be a little bit of extra overhead.
And yeah,
a totally. Lot of you bloat the size of your installers and that sort of stuff. And
if you just put it in the sites folder on a Mac, maybe. That's tricky.
But are you only you're trying to support more than just Macs, though? I'm assuming.
Sure.
I only develop, or my company only develops stuff pretty much for Windows.
Yeah, so that's not going to help you.
Nope.
Doesn't help.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Yeah. We'll pass that right on.
Alright, moving along. Streams in JavaScript?
What about this BR conference?
That was next. Are we on the same page here?
Maybe not.
Yeah, Streams is first.
Streams is first.
Oh, right
Steven.
On it is. I see. Streams in JavaScript. Streams. They are exciting. It's a new data structure. I added this one. Yeah. It says it unlocks a new data structure for you. And goes so far as to say, if you devote 10 minutes of your time to read this page, it may completely change the way you think about programming.
Whoa.
So, look out. But Streams a lot like an array. You know, you make a stream and you pass in some things, and they're in there like an array. You can access them, like you can access things from an array, but a stream can go on infinitely. And how it does that is it doesn't actually go on infinitely, because obviously nobody has memory for that. It is lazily evaluated. So you ask it for anything along this huge stream, and it'll calculate that value on the fly and hand it back to you. They give you some cool examples, like calculating prime numbers to huge limits. It's already nice. People have already ported it over to CoffeeScript, to PHP, Python. And it's not a new thing. It comes from languages like Lisp.
Aha. Haskell. Fancy pants languages.
Yes.
Would you call those hipster languages at all?
Lisp. Yeah. I think, no, Lisp is
no?
Isn't that one of the oldest, second oldest commercially available language?
Yeah.
So, I mean...
What about Haskell? That language has handlebar mustache. Totally.
You could do that.
Anyway.
But wouldn't that just be Ruby, though? All those guys, they sit around in the grassy fields and sandals.
Yeah, I think...
Yeah, it's pretty hipster.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
There was that great video that... You know those videos where it's two cartoon people talking to each other? And one of them was a therapist and one of them was a developer who had done everything in PHP, and it was great. Then all these Rubyists came in, and he's complaining about these bohemian Rubyists who sit around discussing the aesthetic value of placing their if before or after block of code. We'll put that in the...
Yeah, put that in the show notes.
Because it's hilarious. So that's streams.
That's streams, okay. Cool. All right, Cale, your turn.
Okay, I'm not going to go too in-depth with BR Conference, but definitely look it up. But it's really very focused on the mobile web. And their definition of the mobile web is not app-specific. It's very much existing within the web browser, mobile web browsers. Quickly, I'll just say the biggest thing that I came away with at this conference was, media queries is a real big thing right now, and being responsive and adapting to every single view and browser out there. But their big deal is server-side device detection, which is really interesting because they're using the user agent string, which, for so long now has been such a kind of shunned, kind of a no-no thing. But they're really grabbing hold of this and utilizing that. So you're really only serving as much CSS and JavaScript is as needed, specifically if it's a very small screen device, So it was really interesting to hear that and see some of the methods that they're using to do that. Very, very interesting.
And that seems like it's sort of the opposite of the conference Stephen was at, where everything was apps running on HTTP. This is focusing on the web as the platform.
The browser itself.
Yeah,
they were very anti-app, which I was very surprised. Because, Apple's making billions of dollars off of this app platform, and, Android's not far behind, so...
But at the same time, both of these platforms are developing a really great mobile browser.
Yeah, that in WebKit, sure.
Yeah, which is getting more and more functionality all the time. Why are they making that such a great platform when they're making the money off of the apps?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, Apple started out, they wanted you to write everything in the browser, and,
Right.
There was no App Store or app, so... Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of interesting.
And the App Store is really a WebKit browser.
You mean the store itself, or...?
When you open the App Store on your computer, it's just a WebKit view.
You mean, like, the App Store, like the Mac App Store?
Yeah, the one on the, not the one on the iPhone, but the one on your desktop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so is iTunes, right? iTunes is just a WebKit browser, too.
Really?
Isn't it?
I assumed it was.
That's cool.
I always assumed it was, and they've got, you know, they've got the iTunes for Windows, and they've also got Safari for Windows.
You know, Ardeo is also just a browser.
Right, yeah. It's very... It's just just barely any app there.
Are you suggesting that Safari for Windows is a WebKit browser, too?
Don't go crazy now, Jason.
Okay, because that seems like that's just stretching the whole concept.
I know. Really. I don't think anyone uses that, do they?
No.
I don't know why you would.
No.
Yeah.
It's barely tolerable on the Mac anymore.
Yeah, that's the truth. Yeah. I mean, I'm a big Safari fan, and I have switched to Chrome because my computer works now.
Mm-hmm. Once your Mac gets to so old, you just can't afford to run Safari anymore.
Well, even I've got a year and a half old iMac, and it's a huge memory leak to run Safari.
Yeah,
you have to like quit it and open it back up, and
mm-hmm.
yeah,
it's like the best of Firefox right there.
So I'm learning to love Chrome.
I love it.
I'm a big fan.
I'm learning some cool tips and tricks. Like, I was talking to somebody today about how in Safari you can do like command 1, 2, 3, 4 whatever to hit the bookmarks in your bookmark bar. So I have bookmarklets there where I can like hit command 4 and it'll add something to pinboard. To do that in Chrome, you can set up custom search engines. And as the content of the search, just put the JavaScript bookmarklet and then have the keyword be like R to add something to Instapaper. So you go to a page, hit Command L to put your cursor in the Omni bar, type R and hit return. And it's the same as if you clicked on the read it later Instapaper bookmarklet. I love it. That makes Chrome usable to me. yeah.
You don't try Opera?
Get out of here. All right, the next thing on the list was... or Kale, was that...
Yeah, okay. I think that's good.
The next thing on the list was there's a new Peep Code where he does these episodes or whatever of Peep Code where, what's it called, play-by-play, where he sits with a developer and just watches them go through building an app or something like that. But in this new one, he sits down with Ryan Singer of 37 Signals, and he's the lead designer or lead UX guy, and I think it's a two-part episode, but in this first part it's just sketching. So he's got a pad of paper and a red Sharpie marker, and he talks through building an app that I think Jeffrey Grosenbach defined for him, and it's a bicycle race, I think, and it's an app for people to choose who they think is going to win, top 5 out of 200 racers or something like that. And it's great. It's wonderful. Highly recommended. Go ahead.
There's a list here. I was going to say there's a list here of people who recommend this app, and some guy named Trey sees the first 20 minutes. He's already inspired.
Where are you seeing this?
On the link for the peep code.
That's not the only peep code that you're quoted on, Trey.
Really?
Really?
I've definitely... Oh. Seeing you on other ones, I can't remember them right now.
Oh, I didn't know. That's cool.
I am quoted on one too.
You're tweeted. You're quoted. Oh, it may have been a tweet. I don't know. You're quoted two spots away from Tim O'Reilly. So there you go.
That's not bad. I honestly did not know.
You're in good company.
I guess
you're famous.
It's a good episode. I mean, as someone who's, you know, job kind of entails drawing sketches of UI, this is a must have. Download it. Yeah. guess that's... Have you guys watched it at all, or anybody else?
I've watched the preview.
It's good. And I think I added the next item on the list, which is Mulberry, which is another cross-platform mobile thingy for building iOS and Android apps, I guess, from HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, like PhoneGap, like AppCelerator, Cincha Touch, yada, yada, yada. This one, what got me interested in this, because I'm really cynical about that kind of technology, but Rebecca Murphy was, I guess, part of this.
Yes.
And she's big in the JavaScript, jQuery world, and I respect her a lot. So I thought this was worth a look. I'm still fairly skeptical of it in terms of, like, I really...
It's like it's a lot of YAML files, right?
Oh, really? I'm not sure.
I watched the 5-minute intro video that she produced for it.
It's a cool idea. Getting some echo somewhere. You guys hearing that at all?
No.
I am not, no.
Okay. Someone pointed out, you're not going to get a really great native app experience developing with something like this. You could build a quick prototype with it, but in the time it takes to develop a quick prototype with it, you could have a web app. And if you had a web app, then you've got a finished product already.
And wouldn't you look at how when they get really complicated, you start defining screens and all these nested components. It kind of reminds me of what I learned about Cincha Touch. I'd almost rather do that.
Yeah, well, and Mulberry is based on PhoneGap. So I think this is just something that sits on top of PhoneGap.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, but you can run PhoneGap on your Cincha or whatever else.
Hmm.
They make it easy for you with Mulberry, though, which is nice.
But Trey, isn't that always the case with just any sort of write once, run anywhere sort of platform? I mean,
Java applet,
Java apps, Air applet. Yeah, they, you know, they run anywhere. They just look like crap everywhere.
Right. Yeah. Mediocre app everywhere. Yeah.
And you tend to not be able to take advantage of platform-specific advantages.
Right. Right. It seems like it's a quick fix to something that doesn't need a quick fix. Yeah, so... All right. I guess we're all agreed there.
I noticed that the Windows Mobile 7 is not supported by either PhoneGap or Mulberry.
Fail.
It's okay. I don't know. Anybody has one of those phones, so I can't recommend it for them anyway.
I have seen one in action.
Oh, yeah?
And, wow.
Is it cool?
It's very cool, but I don't know that I would ever give up what I already have. You know, bought all these apps.
Yeah.
And the interface looked confusing as hell, but it looked really cool. I mean, it's pretty.
Well, the Windows 8 is going to look just like it, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of grandparents will never upgrade. I mean, just imagine trying to your parents upgrade to Windows 8, and they're asking you, "How do I use this?" And you look at it, you're like, "I have no idea." And you're always supposed to know what to do because you're the child who understands computers.
It's a mixed blessing.
Just put a Google link on their front page is all you can do.
A friend of mine, really good with IT and computers, he put together his own Ubuntu setup for his parents and grandparents. And he installed Google Chrome on it, but he customized the icon to just be Internet Explorer. And just renamed it Internet. They don't even know it. They just double-click on Internet, and they're there, but it's really Chrome.
That's awesome.
Where's that big E for Internet?
Well, yeah. What about the Chromebook? That's perfect for that.
Yeah, it is. Some people I know here in Atlanta have been working on making them better for development.
A lot of people who are used to desktop and even, you know, the desktop environment would have a hard time using the Google Chromebook. And I kid you not, because they would not be able to find the internet on it. It would be the same problem, would not be able to find the big E for internet.
I think that's ironic or something.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I hope the new Chromebooks are not as weak as the prototypes they sent out. Because I got one of the ones they mailed out for free, and it was cool, but really underpowered, and I definitely wouldn't spend $400 or $500 on one like what they seem to be costing now. So,
do you wish you'd sold it when it was hot?
No. Were they hot?
When nobody could get them.
For a little while.
Nah, it was fun. It's got a webcam on it, and you can do the Gmail chat. And the video was really choppy on it, though. Really underpowered. The trackpad was really twitchy. Could not get a click and drag to work. Like, trying to reorder tabs was... Yeah. I'm spoiled by Apple hardware.
I'm excited because we're about to talk about food.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So I'll get through the next thing real quick. I moved my solutions log, which was on WordPress, to Octopress, which is really cool. And it's based on Jekyll, which is this Ruby static site generator. And Octopress is built on top of that, and it has some more kind of niceties. It's got a theme system. It's got rake tasks to generate the posts, so you don't have to get started with Jekyll. You basically have to clone a Jekyll site, delete all the posts out of it, and tweak the theme how you want. Whereas this is more like kind of a cross between Jekyll and WordPress, where it's got a theme set up already. It's got command line stuff to get up and running to preview your content and stuff like that. And it's got the theme that it comes with is cool too, because it's responsive, so it's mobile friendly out of the box. It's basically built for the kind of blog like Solutions Log is, where it's sharing snippets of code and stuff. And it was not too hard to set up. There was some weirdness kind of migrating content out of MySQL into the Markdown files, but it wasn't too bad, and I recommend it. It's cool. It's nice to have all your content in Git. It's nice to be able to... That's the main selling point for me, is being able to have all my content in Git. And I was going to use Jekyll regardless, but Octopress is something nice on top of Jekyll. And it's got also nice for sharing code snippets, language specific syntax highlighting built in.
So you're using Google fonts on here too.
That's the theme, man. I haven't touched the theme yet.
Right on.
So
it does look good.
Yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, I mean, literally, that's just the theme that comes out of the box. I plan on.
I'm complimenting you on your lack of work.
Right. What I did last night was like I moved all this stuff over and actually changed the domain name. It was solutions.treypetemeyer.com, and now it's solutions.trey.cc.
Oh, breaking the internet.
Oh, yeah. No, I redirected everything. Nothing's broken.
Great.
I redirected everything, including the RSS feed.
Nice.
So nothing's broken. 301s. Yeah, anyway.
Wow, it does look really good.
Yeah, Octopress. Try it out. Let's see. That theme could be yours.
I'm tempted.
I do plan on customizing that at some point, but it's nice to have something that clean and easy to read out of the box.
I use Toto, which is a similar thing. Everything's in Git. It's all static files in it. But it actually doesn't compile down to static. I think it just runs on Heroku and it's a Ruby process.
There's more than one way to host an Octopress site. The way I'm doing it, I'm just hosting the site on WebFaction, and one of the deployment methods that it has is an rsync. So you just set up in your config file the your username, your SSH server, and the folder you want to put it in, and you can just run rake deploy, and it builds out the site in just static HTML, rsyncs it to your server, and you're done.
There's no
server component. It's just flat HTML. And then I switched all my WordPress comments to Disqus, which was also very easy. Done. No more upgrading WordPress. Which I'm very happy about.
Yeah, right on.
What is that? Toto was
Toto. Tiniest blog engine in Oz.
Do you have a link for that?
Yes. Well, let's see. Yeah, look in the footer. There we go. There it is.
You got it. Neat.
There's my little blog. So literally, you have a blog in 10 seconds because they give you a starter repository separate than the actual Toto Gym repository.
Ah.
You can clone it down, run Heroku create and push, and bam! You got a blog.
Oh, damn. That's pretty nice.
However, I don't think that at the moment it has an archives page. Basically, your index page has X number that you specify with previews, and then everything's just listed underneath. So, like, the index is also the archive.
Huh.
Like, on mine, eventually you get those unstyled links, because I haven't gotten to them yet.
Does it paginate or something like that?
Never.
Oh.
Now, there are forks out there that paginate, but they haven't been merged in. But you can grab those.
Hmm. That's really cool. I've never heard of that. One other thing, though, I wanted to mention about Octopress is its logo was created by David Lanham of Icon Factory, and his stuff is awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I want to say you should resize my blog, because I added a CSS animation onto the sponsor stuff.
Oh, nice. Oh, that's... Whoa.
But it does not take a full second like it does on CSSdirects.com.
Oh, good. That's nice.
Yeah, looks good.
Why, how long have you had like this butter. Blog? It's like butter.
Hold on.
Do I subscribe to this? To add this to my Google Reader. I'm not subscribed to this feed.
It is... Oh, it's been a month. I'm due for a new post.
Damn, son. Holding out on us.
Yeah. I tweet this stuff.
Dude. All right, I'm subscribed.
Why are you not clicking my links, man?
Apparently not. I am subscribed now. Okay. Cool. That's really neat.
I love the Octopress with a typewriter.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool logo.
Yeah.
All right. So now it's food.
Yeah.
Ooh, what are these images you posted from Milkshake?
Okay, so I posted a couple of images that are really long recipes that are done in a sort of a photo and comic book format, and I love them. I want all recipes done in this format.
Have you made these?
I haven't. But I bet they're good.
2 a.m. chili.
Looks, yeah, that one looks...
Is that one of those things that's only good because it's 2 a.m.?
Is that like the midnight bacon? What is that?
I'm about to be having some of that.
What is that Rachel Ray recipe? You know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't.
She had a recipe for bacon.
But you have to make it at midnight.
Yeah, it's like midnight bacon. You know what I'm talking about? Anyone?
Is it quiet to make, or what's the deal? I don't know.
Hold on, I gotta find it. Hold on.
Anytime's a good time for bacon. So.
This is true.
Somebody is pounding the hell out of that keyboard.
Oh, my mic is on the table.
Yeah.
Here it
Mine
is.
Mine doesn't.
Here it is. Late night bacon. Ingredients: 8 slices of bacon. Directions: place 2 sheets of paper towel on a microwave-safe plate. Lay the bacon out on the paper towel, not overlapping the slices. Place 2 more sheets of paper towel on top. Place the microwave high on top. Place it in the microwave on high for 4 to 6 minutes. That's a recipe on Food Network.
46 minutes?
4 to 6. Did I say 46?
With 1 star. No, this recipe sucks. But, I mean, it's just not as good in the microwave.
I never microwave bacon. Because then...
Don't do it.
How are you going to have your bacon grease to cook with later?
You have to wring out the paper towels. Like. We do that actually when we're in a hurry sometimes, but I got to tell you, the secret to cooking with a microwave that nobody seems to understand is the default is 100% power. You have to cook on half power or less.
What?
You rubberize your meat if you don't.
Oh. So that gives you better quality, that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
And the trick to good bacon is buying good quality bacon.
Yes.
You know,
go to a nice food store and get the thickest stuff. Yeah. Like a kind of semi-local place.
I got some uncured, and I'm doing wiggly fingers, and you can't see.
Cool.
Bacon at Whole Foods.
Yes.
I don't care for it.
Isn't that just sliced pig?
It's sliced pig, and it's paper thin.
They're doing it wrong.
What is the brand that comes in? Like the slices are not like staggered; they're all just stacked. Like it's a chunk of meat that's been sliced up. And it's got a Ziploc, like the bag it comes with has a Ziploc on it.
I don't know. Whatever I buy, they're about 1/8 of an inch.
Yeah, man.
Thick.
You gotta have a thick slice of bacon.
Yeah. I get no money for saying this, but one of my favorite brands is actually Coleman brand.
Where do you get that?
Publix, I think, carries it. Whole Foods. Huh. A lot of the grocery, yeah.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. It's good. It's like Steven's saying, it's you know, pretty good thick stuff. It comes from healthy hogs, I think.
So it says.
Yeah.
I gotta find Wright's. Wright's bacon is what I usually get, and I love it. I'll have to try the Coleman bacon.
Yeah, if you can get ultra local from the farmer's market, that's amazing stuff.
I need to go to the farmer's market. So has anybody cooked anything of note in the last couple weeks?
Well, last week I didn't have a lot of time, so I just bought some eggs, some bacon, some veggies to throw in there, and whenever I found myself at home in the evening needing to cook, I would fry up the bacon, take about half the grease out, and then throw peppers and onions, crack a few eggs on it, and then microwave up a sweet potato, too. Because those are good for you.
Oh, nice. Yeah. How long do you microwave?
It's pretty lazy. That's a total like a man meal, right? Like it's nothing fancy.
How do you microwave a sweet potato? I have one waiting here.
I buy the kind that comes in the plastic that is made for microwaving. However, I bet if you just threw it in there
on half power, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't know. Again, that's mostly for meats.
I don't know how to adjust the power on my microwave. What if I threw away my manual? How do I find that out?
You just push power and 5.
Okay, I'll try that.
Try that.
Okay.
If it burns up your microwave, I'm sorry. I apologize.
Okay.
Meats, they cook so fast on the outside that way, which, I mean, yeah, that was great when you're grilling. But in a microwave, it's not good. It just makes the outside too tough.
So, Jason, are you saying you literally put a raw piece of meat in the microwave to cook it? Other than bacon?
No, usually that would be reheating cooked meats. I would not cook a steak in the microwave.
But you do the half power even for reheating?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Chicken? Yeah, I put it down like 20-30% power.
What about
a couple minutes?
What about a TV dinner?
Oh, no, then, you just follow directions, because, I mean, who cares? You're talking about there's a difference in quality of going out and buying, you know, like nice, thick, local bacon and, you know, TV dinner from Swanson's.
Well, what about an Amy's TV dinner?
Yes. I would follow the directions.
That's expensive. It must be good.
True. I probably should have clarified that. Yeah, generally it's reheating meats or even cooking bacon.
Rachel
Ray says.
Yeah. So is this something you have to set every time, or does it go back to the default?
Yes, it does go back. And I that's why I swear I wish microwaves would just come out of the box on 50% power.
But then you can't cook things as fast.
Yeah.
I guess. But you could cook things with less suck, is all.
You know, I'll go for quick suck over a quality I have to wait for.
Okay.
Oh, that's sad. All right.
So are we talking about cooking then?
Yeah, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. I'll just mention what I cooked tonight. Stephen had mentioned local foods. I happen to live out in the country, as we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast. And there's a beef farm right over the hill, like a quarter mile from my house. So we bought some freezer beef from them in the spring. And so we used some, I guess, I don't know if it was stomach. I don't know. Not stomach, sorry, but what do you call the belly of the cow?
Cow belly.
Flank? I don't know what you call that. Anyway, it was sliced up for fajitas, so we made fajitas tonight with that beef and then some vegetables from my mother-in-law's garden.
Nice.
Yeah, it was good.
How did you cook it?
I'm not good with cooking fajitas that well, so I kind of sautéed the meat for a little while in some sort of Mexican-ish seasoning. And then once that was, you know, more or less cooked and some blood was pushing out, then I put it on a hot griddle to kind of just sear it a little bit.
Nice. Sounds good.
That was our fun home-cooked meal that I'll mention.
Nice.
Delicious.
The kids even ate some of it, so that was good.
Do they not normally eat your cooking?
They're kids. They don't normally. I mean, it doesn't matter. Sometimes they want chicken nuggets. Sometimes they want homemade soup or something. You never know.
Huh. I made a pretty good roast chicken a few days ago. And there's so many varying recipes and heat and time with roasting chicken. But I love how simple it is. Where you get the best value for your meat with a whole chicken. I got it was from Kroger. It was cage free, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it was under $4.
Wow.
It's insane.
Wow.
And so I...
You sure that wasn't a Cornish hen?
It was a chicken.
Okay.
And it wasn't expired or anything.
Awesome. That's great.
So...
wasn't green.
It wasn't even green. I cut up some veggies, some potatoes, onion, garlic, some fresh rosemary. Put some of it in the chicken. Put a slice up a lemon. Put some of that in the chicken. And then a bunch of veggies on the bottom of a casserole dish. And set the chicken on top of it. Brush the chicken with butter.
Yes.
Lots of butter. And put it high heat, 450 degrees for an hour. and then I lowered it to 400 for another about half an hour. So the recipe I was going by, there was one that said 350 for two and a half hours, one that said 450 for an hour and a half. I could have gotten less than that. So I did 450 for an hour and then dropped it to 400 for another half hour. It wasn't dried out, but it could have been a little bit less. And the skin was awesome, brown and crispy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Did you rotate it at all?
No, side to side? I didn't.
Because what you're talking about is, that's how we cook turkeys at Thanksgiving. They're usually smaller birds.
Yeah.
Probably not a lot bigger than your chicken, and but you flip them from side to side every 30 minutes for a couple hours.
Like you flip the whole bird in the container. Whoa,
yeah, it's a pain, but you cook them at really high heat, almost like you're pan frying in the oven or something. But it's really good, and it's actually, I think this Joy of Cooking has it. I think it's called the high heat fry method or something like that.
Wow,
It's dummy proof. If you've never cooked a turkey before, it's an awesome way to cook a bird.
I'm totally intimidated by cooking a turkey, so I'll need to read that.
As were we, so this is why we did this. I think that the description in The Joy of Cooking actually starts, if you've never cooked a turkey before.
Huh. Nice. So, I've roasted chicken before, but I don't think I've ever brushed the skin with butter. And that was amazing. So,
that's great.
Highly recommended. Yeah.
Cool. Well, building on chicken, I made a chicken soup this week. Made from homemade chicken broth, because we do a lot of baked chicken, like you're talking about, Trey. So a little bit of that and leftover chicken. And this is from the America's Test Kitchen cookbook, which I've never had a bad meal from that cookbook. Highly recommend. Just absolutely delicious.
Nice.
Yeah.
This is making me so hungry.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, you guys haven't eaten yet. That's insane.
Yeah, it is.
It's like 1:30 in the morning in Atlanta.
Basically. Right? Or 11 p.m.
Should we ruin your appetite and get on to Star Trek
let's do that.
Let you go.
Oh, right.
Okay, so we're discussing the pilot episode of the original series, which is titled The Cage. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Was I watching the right thing? Were there these guys with these big green heads?
They didn't have green heads. They had big heads.
They had big heads, and there was this like really good-looking blonde girl who...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I couldn't finish it.
The one who could act? The one woman?
Yes.
She made some weird faces, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She did a good job of being kind of different characters, I thought.
Different?
But, I mean, given woodenness of the rest of the cast, it wasn't hard.
And the She-Hulk character?
Yeah. So I'll just say I didn't know what to expect. I haven't watched a lot of the original series, and this was probably better than I expected. It was a little bit hard to get into, and maybe this is where you're coming from, Steven, because none of the characters are the characters you're used to. The only Star Trek staple is Mr. Spock.
Right.
Who, by the way, in my opinion, looked exactly like Zachary Quinto.
Is that the new Spock?
Yeah, he was the new Spock.
Hmm. Oh. You're saying that in this episode he looked like...
Yes, the or Spock. Zachary Quinto looked just like a very young Leonard Nimoy, I guess would be a better way to put it.
Huh, I guess they casted that properly, huh?
Yeah. I think he'd been told that all his life anyway. So. Quinto, that is, not Leonard Nimoy. Nimoy doesn't give a crap, I don't think. He doesn't care about anything.
So, what did you guys think of this episode?
Well, I'll have to give it another shot. Like I said, I couldn't finish it.
I thought it was kind of good.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I was able to go through the whole thing. It was interesting to see their portrayal of like high technology, you know, 50 years ago.
You mean the clipboards?
Yeah, and the mainframes printing out hard copies of things.
Yeah. It was clearly somebody pushing a piece of paper through a slot in the cardboard.
it was like
coming out crooked for part of it.
I've been going through on Netflix and watching all of The Next Generation, and I intended before we were doing this to go watch all the first series. But anyway, so there's lots of things in this that I've seen the newer versions of. Lots and lots, and it's funny how there's these specific explanations for things that are very commonplace in the Star Trek universe, but this is just introducing it. Like, where Spock goes, it's a Class M planet. Oxygen atmosphere. Stuff like that.
And with almost that exact same delivery, too.
Yeah. And the tricorder just looks like something that someone put together from Radio Shack parts. And
not even Radio Shack. It's like just found objects.
Yeah.
Honey, do you need that little colander? It was like a little mesh thing that flipped
yeah.
up.
Yeah. And
strainer.
And, the, like there was a, a couple of kids walking through the hallways, the corridors of the Enterprise, and one of them was wearing a polo shirt. And it's like, wait a minute.
Yeah, I'm on the Enterprise, bro.
He didn't have his collar popped.
His collar wasn't popped.
No. Oh, okay. No. But it was an interesting story, and I thought the pulsing headed aliens were, even for Next Generation standards, pretty good makeup.
Yeah, it was subtle.
Yeah, because that was 60s, right?
Yeah.
Did it? You know, I couldn't help but the whole time I was watching it, just the kind of the theme, almost like there's a lesson about living a virtual life. It could be paradise, but you know, something like that. But anyway, it struck me as it could have been a Twilight Zone script.
Yeah.
Had Star Trek never taken off, this could have just been aired as a Twilight Zone.
Yeah. And there's a lot of... It didn't have the feel of Star Trek in a lot of ways, in terms of like the music and, of course, the cast. After I finished this, I started just the first few minutes of the next episode, and it's all the real cast. I mean, there's Captain Kirk and there's Bones and everybody. Like, and it feels so much more comfortable right away. It seems like the right thing. The whole feel of this episode was kind of un-Star Trek like, coming from someone who hasn't seen a lot of the original series.
Yeah, well, I have to admit, my wife is the total Star Trek nerd and always has been. And I mentioned about, you know, you had put this on the list of things to talk about tonight and what we should watch it together. And she says, oh, that's the pilot with Captain Pike.
Mm-hmm.
No, this is the original series. This has Captain Kirk. No. She's trying to explain to me, and I totally didn't believe her. Like, you don't know what you're talking about.
Why?
She was absolutely right. I don't know why I doubted the Star Trek queen would have not known exactly.
That's
what
funny.
She's
so it was funny. I was talking to Johnson earlier tonight, and he's like, "If you're talking about Star Trek, you've got to get Angela on."
Yeah.
So tell her to call in.
I should. Yeah, she's probably upstairs. Just have it ringing on her phone.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it would be interesting to sort of talk about the plot of it or whatever, or just to discuss our feelings about like the gist of it or whatever. But it's a fairly long episode for a story where not much happens.
It was light on action, that's for sure. In that regard, it was probably the most realistic portrayal of a futuristic naval ship I've ever seen.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it just in the sense of, you know, they would, you know, the captain would say, "Let's go," and then they would all just kind of stare blankly at the screen ahead of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was the emphasis they put on when they're going to time warp, and the special effects they use for the time warp and the time warp factor 7, and the whole ship sort of fades in and out of existence and has this crazy music, and yeah.
Yeah, I love the music. I thought that was great. That's one of the best parts.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think the original series theme is used in the show, but not as the theme. It's just like the, I don't know, traveling music or something.
Oh, like the weird sort of lounge music kind of theme, or
yeah, that's what I like.
No, not that one. Anyway, I wouldn't begin to try to hum it for you. I did recognize, I think, some of the music,
huh.
But yeah. Well, I think my favorite character, aside from the blonde, the female lead of this episode,
yeah,
was there was a blonde haired fella. I don't know if he was like the communications officer or something.
Yeah.
He was like a Will Wheaton-ish, I don't know, like a Wesley Crusher sort of prototype. And I wanted him at some point to say, "You know, gee willikers, we can travel faster than light, sir." I mean, he was such a like a 50s throwback. It was hilarious.
Yeah.
But what about the whole thing at the end that they're like attempt at humor, you know? Like it's like the whole show is very serious, and then at the end, you know, you have the doctor in there and the captain's like making some kind of dirty old man comment.
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah, that was really weird.
What is, there was
it fell flat as humor. It actually came across as he really seems like a dirty old man.
Right. But that's when they were talking about the whole Adam and Eve thing, right? And that young girl came up to him and said, "Who would have been your Eve?"
Yeah, the yeoman. Yeah, who would have been your Eve?
Yeah, she was the one who had the what was it? Enhanced female. What was it that the big headed alien said? Basically, she had a huge sex drive, unnaturally large, yeah. Female drive.
Yeah. Early 60s talk for. She's a teenager.
I'm amazed that Pike didn't head off with one of these girls like Riker or Kirk would have.
Yeah, really. Truly not a Kirk.
No, definitely not. And well, he was so like angst-ridden. I can't do this anymore. Like he had the powwow with the doctor who gave him the martini in his quarters.
Yeah, that was cool.
He's very un-other Star Trek captain-like, because no other Star Trek captain would have had that kind of questioning their duty at all, I don't think.
I think Janeway was just as wooden as he was, but yeah, probably didn't question her duty.
I haven't seen a lot of a Voyager, like almost none.
It's not my favorite. The animated series is still one of my favorites, so I can't wait till you get to that.
Yes! That's on Netflix now. It's streaming.
Yes, yes, it is. I'm so glad.
That's great. So, I think all of Star Trek, period. Maybe some movies are missing, but all of the TV series are streaming now.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, I think so. Pretty much everything's on there.
So, yeah, I mean, I think as long as we can all tolerate it, we should go through all this.
Yeah, that was my first episode, so I'm ready.
So, Jason, Kale has, like, never seen any Star Trek.
Wow, really?
Yeah, that was my very first episode.
Well, you've got a long way to go. it does get better.
Yeah, it does. Although, I'll say that this episode was better than the first few episodes of The Next Generation.
Hmm. Yeah, that one really started rough.
Yeah, it did.
it was definitely a very cheesy, late 80s looking.
But it does get a lot better.
But yeah, and Next Generation kind of came about, not to completely just fast forward, you know, 30 years or anything, but it came about kind of as that, I don't know if it was computer animation, and just there was a boom of science fiction programs on the air at that time, and it really benefited from that a lot, that the effects of that show got really good. But for what it's worth, to start, like you said, I was impressed for what the effects were in this pilot episode of Star Trek.
What effects, like the laser beam trying to get into the underground layer of the aliens?
Well, the props, the physical props. I thought those phasers they had were just awesome looking.
Yeah, they look better than the phasers on Next Generation, which look like remote controls.
Yeah, really. Yeah, no, they're just super cool. I mean, they look like they would blast a hole through a door.
Although they twisted and turned the knobs on it like it was a garden hose attachment or something.
Dial that in.
I really liked the sets too. Especially the really vivid colors, like the purple rock walls in the cells where they were held captive, and the purple and whatever green, I think, cape he wore in that one scene with the where she was green.
Yeah, the kind of the hedonistic looking scene.
Yeah, I thought the sets and the costumes and the colors were really cool and vivid.
Yeah, and just the fact that like that was all real, you know, all literal, like somebody.
Yeah, there's no computers.
All of that.
Yeah. So this was 1964 mm-hmm. or 65. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page here.
Impressive.
Yeah, you know, I recently read a blog post. I'll have to see if I can find it. Some artist lamenting the decline in the use of color in modern film. He was saying all modern film looks very blue and purple to him.
Huh.
As opposed to the 60s, where they had this, you know, real vibrant look, although there was a little bit of a green tinge, I think, of a lot of stuff from that era. But yeah, just talking about, like you said, just so colorful.
Yeah.
I guess Technicolor would be the best term. It definitely was very bright. The sets look good. Especially, again, given it's a pilot episode, I mean, who knows? They were probably filming on old sets from, you know, Lost in Space or something at that time. Who knows?
Yeah. That's crazy. Let me just say that I'm kind of jealous of Christopher Pike's. He looked freshly shaven, but he had like the Homer Simpson, like pre-5 o'clock shadow. Like, did people in the '60s just look like that? I don't know anybody who has that heavy. Like, you could just see the stubble about to pop out of his face.
Makeup.
It could have been makeup. It looked natural though.
Yeah. He was one hell of a rugged looking dude. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very square.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I think I would have enjoyed to see him as the captain of something else again, but I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Who was the in the new movie, not to spoil it for you, Kale, who was the captain before? I guess it was Kirk's father. No, never mind. That was Kirk's father.
Yeah. I think there was an Admiral Pike. I think Pike is a character that lives on in the legacy of Star Trek.
Okay, cool. Okay.
I don't think he was completely just forgotten.
Interesting.
I'll have to find out. Wikipedia, don't fail me now. But, also, another little interest bit was Majel Barrett was the first officer in this pilot. That is Roddenberry's wife.
What? Wait a minute. That's Troy's mom.
Yeah, she plays many characters throughout Star Trek.
So that was
she's the voice of the ship too. Like when the doors,
I did not make that connection.
She looked familiar. I had to look it up though. I had to check.
Lwaxana Troi.
Yeah, that's her.
Wow. That's cool. I had no idea.
I guess she's the head nurse later on. Whoa, talk about a demotion, right?
Yeah, really? From first officer to nurse.
But, yeah, she definitely... she's still alive. I don't
know.
No, she's
December 18th, 2008.
Fairly recently passed away. That's what I thought. But, yeah, she continued to be active in the Star Trek universe for her entire life, I think.
Huh. That's pretty cool. I was listening to the Will Wheaton's Memories of the Future.
Yeah, that's a great podcast, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I listened to all the episodes of the podcast. I haven't read the book yet, but it was really good. And he talks about how everyone loved Lwaxana Troi. How do you pronounce her first name?
I think it's Majel.
Majel Barrett. Yeah. And before I had started listening to that podcast, and I had seen some episodes of Next Generation with her in it, like, she just kind of grated on my nerves. But after hearing how the cast just adored her, like, I gave her more of a benefit of the doubt. And she is an entertaining character as Lwaxana Troi. And how she, like, flummoxes Picard so much. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, no, of course, if Will Wheaton says that her name is different, you go with Will. Don't go with
him. Yeah, I don't remember what he said on that.
So, yeah, there's Kale. There's many, many more interesting episodes to watch.
Yeah, it sounds very intricate. So.
Yeah.
It is added to my queue.
Yay.
Yeah, he was in the reboot, the 2009 film.
He was.
He's the one who basically. Talks to the young James Kirk to basically join Starfleet.
Who?
Pike.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, sorry. I shouldn't use pronouns after.
I thought you were talking about Will Wheaton. I don't remember Will Wheaton, but he should have been in that. That would have been cool.
He should have. That's true.
Okay, so that was Pike. So that was the same character as the pilot episode?
Yeah, and he does come back. I don't know if the same actor comes back in the original series, but he does come back.
Oh, that's cool. In
that character in several other episodes. Which is, I mean, again, I had to get all this from my wife. She's
yeah.
Star Trek dictionary.
Yeah, maybe if you want to have her call in during the Star Trek section of next week's. we could do the Star Trek part first.
Actually, later would be better.
Oh, okay. We can do it later.
The kids and all. I'll have to have her do this. She would enjoy that.
Yeah, it'd be awesome.
She'll really want to talk about Next Generation. That's her favorite. That's what she grew up on.
We got to pace it. There's 80 episodes of the first series.
Really? There is? Wow.
Three seasons. That's a lot of episodes.
Yeah, they really cranked them out, didn't they?
I guess we could skip ahead.
Whatever you guys want to watch.
You guys want to try to go through all of the original series? As long as we can stand it?
Three at a time or something.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
Every couple of weeks or.
Yeah. Could do like 5-10 minute summaries or opinions of whatever episode or something.
Yeah. Once you get to the animated series after that, they're only 22 minutes long.
Nice.
23 or something. They go really fast.
I started to watch that on StarTrek.com when you blogged about it.
Yeah. I think they put the CBS posted them on StarTrek.com about a year ago or something.
Yeah, I started to watch it on that, and I did enjoy it, but I didn't stick with it. But now that I'm on a Uber Star Trek kick,
give it another go.
I'll give it another go.
Awesome,
cool. I guess we should call it quits for this one. This is good.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys for letting me join in today. This was awesome.
Yeah, definitely. And you're welcome to join in every week if you are interested.
I will do my best.
Cool. All right. We'll talk to you guys later.
All right. Thanks a lot, Trey.
Cool.
Thanks,
right. See you all later.
Bye.
Bye.